You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 583. So where's the Cannes Film Festival being held this year? Christina Aguilera.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Enigma Elements. As filmmakers, we're always looking for ways to level up production value of our projects and speed up our workflow. This is why I created Enigma Elements, your one-stop shop for film grains, color grading LUTs, vintage analog textures like VHS and CRT images, smoke, fog textures, DaVinci Resolve presets, and much more. After working as an editor, colorist, post, and VFX supervisor for almost 30 years, I know what film creatives need to level up their projects. Check out EnigmaElements.com and use the coupon code IFH10 to get 10% off your order. I'll be adding new elements all the time. Again, that's Enigma, E-N-I-G-M-A, elements.com. Well, guys, today on the show, we have the co-founder of Slam Dance and writer-director, Dan Mirvish. Now, we're going to talk about Dan's amazing new film, 18 and a Half, but we're also going to talk about the state of film festivals today. Are film festivals worth it anymore? How to submit to film festivals if you're going to? What the true economics are of running a film festival, and so much more. So without any further ado, please enjoy my eye-opening conversation with Dan Mirvish. I'd like to welcome back to the show returning champion, Dan Mirvish. How you doing, Dan?
Good to see you, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
Of course, brother. Of course. You know, you've been on the show a couple times. I mean, you were in my last movie.
Yes. And my book was in your last movie.
Your book was in my last movie. You were in my last movie. You gave me a great little blurb in the back of Rise of the Filmtrepreneur. And we've partied a bit over at Sundance back when we could do things like that.
And you could.
back in the olden days. But I appreciate you coming on, man. So for everybody who doesn't know who the Dan Mirvish is... Can you give them a quick little rundown on your history and what you did and what you're doing?
Sure. I like most people, I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, and but I majored in history and political science. Only did a little bit of film as an undergrad, like a Super 8 class and some summer classes at UCLA. Then worked in DC for a couple of years as a Senate speechwriter. Then went to USC Film School. And got my master's degree there. And while I was there, instead of a short film for a thesis film, I did a feature film called Omaha the Movie. And I think I was the first student to figure out the loopholes to do a feature film there. And was lucky enough to be mentored by Robert Altman on that film. And then, of course, that film didn't get into Sundance. So I helped co-found the Slam Dance Film Festival in January 95 and still stayed involved with that up till now. And And then meanwhile, I've just kept making indie films along the way and written a couple books too. I wrote a couple editions of The Cheerful Subversive's Guide to Independent Filmmaking, which thanks to you, Alex, and your advice is now available also as an audiobook. So thank you for that. And, but mainly every, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years, however long between movies, I make independent films. So I've done a couple musicals. I did a film called Open House. There was a real estate musical, which was, we helped change the rules of the Academy Awards, which is a whole other long story. I did a play adaptation called Between Us with Julia Stiles and Taye Diggs and David Harbour and Melissa George. And the last film I did was called Bernard and Huey, which was written by Jules Pfeiffer and had David Koechner and Jim Rash in it. And then this film, 18 and a half, which is an original script I wrote with my friend Daniel Moya. And, you know, he wrote the screenplay. We came up with the story together, but it's set around the time of Watergate, and is about a young woman who gets a hold of the missing 18 and a half minute gap in the Nixon tapes and tries to leak it to a reporter, and they run afoul of swingers, hippies, and nefarious forces out to get them.
Well, I'm sure back in the day, looking in hindsight, that Sundance wishes that they accepted your film.
Well, eventually it played on the Sundance channel, and in their program notes, it actually said, and the film played at Sundance. So, I guess they sort of retroactively put it in. Go figure.
So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, before we get into your new film, 18 and a half, I wanted to talk to you about film festivals, because, you know, you started one of the larger film festivals in the country, arguably in the world, and one of easily the top 10 film festivals that actually mean something in the world today, Slamdance. What is the biggest mistake that you see filmmakers make with film festival submissions in general?
I think just submitting blindly, you know, onto Film Freeway or something, or, you know, or similar things, without any kind of introduction or follow-up, or connection to the festival, is is a big mistake. You know, or then not doing research on if it's even the right fit for your film. I think that's another kind of related mistake. I think that, you know, and it doesn't mean that you have to know someone ahead of time, but you need to try to get to know someone, you know, and reach out to them personally one way or another, not in an intrusive way, but, you know, and really say, you know, is this film the right fit for your festival, generally speaking. But then really what that does is it gets your name a little bit, you know, floating in their consciousness, like, oh yeah, that was that person that emailed me or called me or ran into me at another festival. And, you know, I'll take their film a little bit more seriously. So I think that's the thing, is what I think just submitting blindly just doesn't, you know, to any festival, it just lowers your odds tremendously. And, any kind of personal connection you can make to the festival director, the programming director, the artistic director, depending on what the title is. But then also just to help narrow down, the number of festivals you're going to submit to, because it can get expensive, is do the research, find films that were similar to your own film in genre and length and style, from like a year or two before, and see where did they apply to, where did they play, where did they get in, and either contact the filmmakers or just look on their websites. Usually you can kind of figure that out. And then, you know, and then at some point find out, was it good for those filmmakers? Was it a good festival? Was it worthwhile? And in what ways was it worthwhile? Because, you know, not every festival is going to have a million distributors, you know, hungry to take your film, but there's plenty of festivals that you're going to have great experiences at, meet other filmmakers, meet investors, go on a vacation. You know, there's a lot of great reasons to go to a lot of different festivals, and they're not always the same reasons.
Now, do you think that it's important for filmmakers? Because I've seen this mistake happen so many times, and my films over the years have gotten, I think, 500 or 600 film festivals, I think, at this point in the game, back in the day since 2005 when I started submitting to festivals. 1805, obviously. Yeah. Even 1905 is still old. But do you believe that it's helpful to have a nice presence on the web, have a trailer, have like make your film look a little bit bigger than it truly might be purely through the web, through just through the your web presence, a nice poster, these kind of things to make the festival look at it and go, oh, there's something here. There's more value here than just another film from another filmmaker. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, definitely. Because, you know, every festival programmer at some point, and maybe if they, you know, when they're first looking at your film or when they're making their final decisions, they're going to Google you, you know, and make sure you're not weird. But and they'll all look at IMDb Pro and make, you know, see if you can get your film on there or Wikipedia or whatever it is. And even if it's a short, have a trailer for the short, you know, it doesn't matter. Even if it's a 1 minute short, make a 10-second trailer.
It's a teaser.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody should be doing things like that. I think absolutely right. Yeah, give it as much oomph as you can.
Now, I have to ask you the question because, you know, I've said this so many times on the show before, but I'd love to hear your opinion on it. Film festivals, I think filmmakers still think that film festivals have the power that they did back in the 90s and early 2000s, where back in the day in the 90s, when you got into Sundance, it truly meant, it still means something today, but it was like you were going to get sold just because you got into Sundance, or because you have a laurel on your poster, a distributor is going to have a better chance getting it out there. You're going to make more money with it. But those days are kind of, in my opinion, kind of gone to a certain extent. What value does a film festival, even the top 5 or 10, have to the bottom line? Not experiences, because you and I both know Sundance and going to Park City is, and Slamdance, it is amazing. It's so much fun. You meet people. So there's a lot of other benefits. There's there's lectures, there's webinars, there's seminars, all this kind of stuff. But I'm talking about the bottom line as far as an investment is concerned, because filmmakers have that kind of delusion. They're like, oh, if I get into Slamdance or Sundance or South By or something, it's an automatic, where I know and you know filmmakers who've won Sundance, won Slamdance, won South By, won all these, and their films didn't get sold or couldn't, didn't move the needle. So what's your opinion on that?
Well, I think, you know, I differ a little bit with you. I think it is still important. I mean, I remember in 95 or actually, you know, fall of 94, the distributor saying, oh, we love your film. We want to pick it up for distribution if it gets into Sundance.
Right.
And if it doesn't, we don't. And they were very matter of fact about it. Cut to, you know, 2000 or what year are we? 2020, you know,
2022.
And I still have distributors have the exact same conversation with me. Oh, we really love your film, but you know, if it had played in Sundance or South By or Cannes or Berlin, yeah, we would have picked it up for distribution. But if not, we're not going to. Now, but the reverse isn't true. I think that's what you're hitting on, is that you can still get into Sundance, you can still get into South By and still not get distribution. It's not and even in the 90s, that wasn't a guarantee at Sundance either. There were still films that weren't getting picked up. So it's a little bit of a myth in that regard. But if you don't get into those top festivals, it is very, very difficult. Now, that said, I've never gotten my films into Sundance. I have gotten my films into South By, but back in 95 when South By was just in the second year, so it didn't really mean as much then. But I think what I've been able to do with most of my films, really, well, pretty much all my films, is to play at the kind of the next tier down, the A-minus and the B-plus festivals, and somehow manage to create enough buzz and momentum from a volume of festivals and accumulating awards, audience awards, jury awards, you know, critical reviews, blurbs, and eventually you can get some distributor somewhere to pay attention to you in a way that that even just, you know, a failed film at Sundance may not even get that attention. And certainly that was the case with 18 and a half. We started playing, you know, last fall, we premiered at the Woodstock Film Festival, which is a great film festival, but it's it's not an A-list festival, but it's an A-minus B plus.
Absolutely. Yeah,
it's certainly respectable. And, you know, but also it was partially by design and partially by luck. Yeah, there was this trough between the Delta variant and the Omicron variant.
I remember that trough.
Where you could have live festivals, you know, because for a year, all festivals were virtual. And then they all thought they were going to be back live in 2021. And then Delta happened. And they was like, whoa, hang on a second. You know, Toronto was virtual then. But then, you know, there was about a 2 month gap there. And we were like, you know what? We had just finished the film. We are going to go hard and heavy into festival circuits. We did like 10 festivals in 2 months. In the U.S., you know, we won the top prize at Tallgrass in Wichita, which actually came with money, which was amazing. We played internationally. The international premiere was at Sao Paulo International Film Festival. Went to Europe in Spain for the European premiere at the Gijón Film Festival, which is like the third biggest festival in Spain. But around the U.S., Rome International in Rome, Georgia, and where we won a prize. Anchorage, St. Louis, you know, a bunch of festivals. And it was based on those awards and that presence and that kind of geographical spread that we had to prove that it wasn't just a US-centric film. Whistler, Canada, that was our Canadian premiere. That based on that, we literally, that's what got us our distribution deal with a London-based sales agent, international sales agent called 101 Films that also does direct VOD distribution in both North America and England and the UK and Ireland. And then once we got that, then we got a theatrical distributor and an airline distributor and a DVD Blu-ray distributor as separate deals.
So you split up all your deals.
Yeah.
You split up all your rights.
Exactly. So
which is go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No. So I wanted to kind of point that out to people is that a lot of filmmakers think that you have to just give all your rights to the one distributor. Mm-hmm. That is not true. I mean, some of them ask for it,
right?
But if you can carve out, like, not everyone, no one's going to do airline if they're not specializing in airline. No one's going to do the theatrical now unless they specialize in that or mm-hmm. have a mm-hmm. strength in it, or DVD, or yeah, you know, exactly. or SVOD or AVOD or TVOD, mm-hmm. and there's 1,000 rights that you can give away. You know, you can carve up. And then there's international and different countries and things like that. So that's a really great lesson for everyone listening is that you really should think about how you carve out those rights. But all right, so going back to the festival circuit, I agree with you 100% that because I couldn't get into any of the big festivals when I was starting out at all. So what I did the exact same thing. My first short was in 185 film festivals I just stopped.
Yeah.
I just after like a year and a half or 2 years of it, because I submitted to it was a different time period. It was 2005, but I just kept and I didn't pay. I refused to pay after like 40 of them. I was like, I'm not paying anymore.
Right.
So
right.
I just kept going in there. So it was this volume that mm-hmm. everyone just said, Jesus, it's gotten into like 100 film festivals or it's gotten to so many that you lack of quality, you get quantity. It helps. So like when I was watching your trailer, I saw with 20 film festival laurels all at once, which was impressive. And I recognized in the time that it flashed by, I was like, oh, there, I know that festival. And then it was gone. But I knew and I was like, oh, that's a really great technique on how to use film festivals, because film festivals just other people one laurel or two laurels. You just like, nah, man, we did 20 film festivals and boom. And so that
gives in a global pandemic, you know. And did them live. Yeah. Yeah. Because after that fall trough, we then did a spring trough tour, you know, between Omicron and World War III. There was a nice little trough of festivals we could go to.
Yes, of course. Yeah. We can't forget World War III. Forget World War III as well. That's we're joking about it, but we're not really. It's not a joke at all about what's going on. But and God forbid, who knows what the hell that's going to end up being. But yeah, so I agree with you. And I think we're both on the same page because that myth of like, oh, you just get into Sundance, it's sold is false. But it's still in today's marketplace. Getting into Sundance is great. It's better than not, but mm-hmm. the film has to be marketable. The film has to
exactly.
Have
and And the other thing too is that, you know, I had a pretty good feeling, probably more than most people, that Sundance wasn't going to be live this year. You know, I mean, they only canceled the week before.
I know.
At Slam Dance, we canceled like 3 weeks before because we knew. But even, you know, when I was deciding to play Woodstock, I already had enough clues that this film wasn't going to get in. It wasn't either going to get into Sundance. And if it did get into Sundance, Sundance wasn't going to be live. And if it's not live, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, we're filmmakers. We want to engage with an audience. You know, if a film is virtual, but nobody knows you played it virtually, did you really play it? It's like the tree in the forest.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So I was, I'm a big believer, like go to wherever the audience is, however you can do it to drive in. If it's virtual, but you can engage with an audience, great, go for it. But yeah, I wasn't going to wait around for a virtual festival that I knew I probably wasn't going to get into, because also just keep in mind, in these days, 2020, most festivals are showing half as many films as they did before. And meanwhile, there's a backlog of twice as many films trying to get in. So you actually have a 25% and one quarter chance of getting into any given festival than you might have 2 years ago. So, which means you have to apply to four times as many festivals to hope to get into anything. And you've got to be nimble because festivals are changing. They're like, oh, we're going to be live. No. There's a new variant. We're going to go virtual. A festival may call you up a week before and go, oh, we have a slot that just opened up. Do you want to play here? And you've got to be nimble and flexible and say, you know what, I can't go, but my composer can go. Like he went to Brazil on my behalf, or my cinematographer went to Wichita to you know, represent the film at Tallgrass, and we wound up winning. I should send her to everything, you know. So you just have to be nimble about all this stuff and just go wherever makes sense at any given time. But if you wait around for the 6 months to get rejected from an A-list festival, you're going to be waiting around for another 6 months for the next A-list festival to reject you. So, if you can get out there and somehow find an audience one way or another, do it.
Now, how many submissions do you guys get in Slam Dance still? Because I know are you still like involved heavily or not?
Because we're all filmmakers, by unemployed filmmakers for unemployed filmmakers is our motto. And so when I've been working on my own films, I'm not involved with the programming at all, thankfully, because it is so time consuming, but it's all done by alumni. So it's nice to get different people every year to be programmers. But we get like 8,000 submissions. I mean, I think most of those are shorts, but it's a lot. And, you know, and at that level, you know, it's kind of a crapshoot whether you get in or not. It's not about how good your film is, because there's a lot of other good films applying too. And, you know, same with Sundance. At least with Slam Dance, there's no politicking. There's no early invitations. We don't, you know, it doesn't matter if you know someone or don't know someone. Sundance, that, you know, honestly, their problem is that I think their problem now is that they have so many labs that they wind up obligated to show all these lab films that take up half the slots or more than half the slots, whether the films are good or bad, they kind of have to take them. And so there just aren't as many, you know, and then whatever politicking that goes on as well, you know, that could be a whole podcast, but there just aren't that many like openly available slots anymore. And you just have to know that going in and realize your chances are slim to next to none.
And just so people understand that there is no politics at Slam Dance, I know you well. You were in my movie, and that movie did not get into Slam Dance.
That's
so,
right.
Yes. So, I mean, you know, oh, and I shot part of the movie at Slam Dance. So,
yeah, exactly.
No, sorry, it doesn't. So there's no politicking. So I firsthand experience, there are no politics at Slam Dance.
All right, brother.
Yeah. It's all good. That whole film was such a fun process to go.
Yeah, it was fun.
Super fun. So can you touch upon the economics of film festivals? Because I think a lot of filmmakers don't understand what it really takes to put on a festival, what the costs are, where they make their money. Is it a break even? Is it a for profit? Like all these things. So at least from your point of view, doing this for so long.
So, yeah, I mean, and it is good for filmmakers to think about it, like from that perspective. So festivals, most festivals make their money or support their budget, and they don't, most of them are nonprofits or don't profits, but they make their money or their income from either box office sales at the festival itself, sponsorship, either from their local community or businesses or some combination thereof, and submission fees. Those tend to be the three big. I think that's it. Remind me if there's anything else. But
merchandise,
and a little bit of merchandise and merch that they can sell. Those tend to be the three big drivers of their thing. So if there's a, you know, if there's a global pandemic or economic downfall or whatever, you know, that's going to impact festivals in different ways depending on what they are. I mean, if 70% of their income comes from box office and there is no box office, they're tanked, and a lot of festivals went under, you know, or went dormant during the pandemic because of that. But on the other hand, if a higher percentage of their budget comes from submission fees, then you can survive a little bit longer just economically. But the relevant thing to filmmakers is to think about, well, all those festivals, especially the ones that are particularly reliant on sponsorship and box office, they need big name actors in their films. They need big name directors to show up and do Q&As. Just as much, like, it took me like 20 years to figure this out. Like, oh, what's the point of getting stars in your film, like name actors? It's not just to get distribution. It's to get into festivals too. And there's a reason for it. They, you know, they're trying to get people in their doors and get people to give them money. So, and once you realize that, like, what then it makes you realize, okay, what can I offer to that festival? Like, okay, if I have big names, great. You know, if I have, but even just to say it's a premiere, you know, even a short film, you know, to say, oh, it's the Carolina premiere or the North Dakota premiere, whatever premiere it is, make something up, you know, because that's something that the festival can then use to generate some excitement about that film.
You know, it's really interesting too, because when I had my film, some of my films had some stars in it and people involved in it. And I had festivals like, will that person show up before I got accepted?
Yeah.
Like, that would be the determining factor essentially. And that's the politics of behind the scenes stuff. Like, I've literally had phone calls like, can that actor show up? And if he can't, we have another one down. The next movie online has another actor of similar caliber.
Yep. Yeah.
And it's not always about if the movie's good or not, honestly.
Right. I mean, or if you have a band, will the band play, you know, things like that.
I remember sitting down in 2005 or 06 and I at a shorts package at Sundance. And all of a sudden I see this horribly produced short film about Batman and Robin on a date. Like Robin's on a date and Batman comes in and tries to steal Robin's date. That's basically the whole short. And I'm like, this is horribly produced. It's bad. And then I'll go, oh, well, it's Justin Long is Robin and Sam Rockwell is Batman. Done.
There you go. That's it.
That was the perfect, that was the moment that I understood even back then. I was like, oh, these guys need asses in seats.
Yep.
They need star power as well. If it's not actors, then it's a writer or it's a filmmaker or it's someone of some sort of magnitude that they can bring on, and people, other film festival people would love to see them talk. Or
I mean, there's a reason, you know, Top Gun Maverick is playing at Cannes.
You know, right.
Tom Cruise is there, you know, like.
Oh, yeah. They called up like, will Tom be there? Yeah. Okay. You can play.
Yeah.
You can play. Is George Miller's new movie? Sure. We'll play George Miller's new movie. Yeah. Like, it doesn't, like, it just George showing up. Sure. Like, absolutely. But that's the thing that they don't tell filmmakers. They don't, you know, and so many filmmakers are so starry eyed about the process. And there's been so much myth over the years about film festivals that I really want to kind of, I've pulled the curtain back a little bit. I'm like, look, guys, look, this is the reality of what you're going to be dealing with. And now more than ever, things are changing so rapidly, like you were saying. Sundance canceled. I had friends of mine, like, I booked hotels, I booked flights, I'm losing money. Like, it destroyed. I mean, imagine, remember South by, when the pandemic blew up?
Yeah, I was shooting 18 and a half at the time. And we were like, South by's closed? Wow.
Like that. Yeah, after they sold tickets.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It was like, I'm surprised I didn't knock them. They were big enough of a festival, because the film festival is like this big. Comparatively
exactly.
The rest of South by, which is everything else. So they could handle it, but still it was pretty. So in the world that we're living today, it's not you know, it's not what it, everything's always the same. It's changing so, so dramatically. Now I have to ask you, because you've been around the block, a couple times, you've worked with distributors in the past. I'm assuming that every distributor ever in your life has paid you promptly and has not taken advantage of you in any way, shape, or form.
I believe the phrase you're looking for is every distributor has gone bankrupt. So I think that was more.
They
go bank,
and then they reopen a week later under a new name.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. And then they buy the catalog for pennies on the dollar under the new brand. And now they own it 100%.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Things like that, right? So that's another thing too, is a lot of filmmakers go to film festivals hoping that the almighty distributor will come down from Mount Hollywood and write them a big fat check and they don't have to worry about anything. But in your experience, even in today's world, the fat check doesn't really exist. The MG is very difficult to get nowadays, unless you've got major star power or at a different level in film for an MG to make sense. You have big stars, action, or certain genres that kind of get those things. But what's your experience with that right now?
Well, I got not a huge MG, but then an MG is basically minimum guarantee or in advance. We did get one from one of our distributors. So nice. The international sales company, God bless them. And honestly, that was a big reason we went with them, because the reality is, you know, some people look at these contracts and they're like, ooh, I'm getting a bigger percentage on the back end in this one compared to this other one. I was like, dude, you're never going to see that. You know, like if you're getting any money up front, take it. Because that's all you're going to see. And that's, you know, and it's not just because distributors are going to actively screw you. A lot of times they just passively screw you. They're like, you know, they could be trying as hard as you are, but they're just not good at it, or they just go bankrupt. You know, it's like, well, dude, we tried. Sorry.
I love the term passively screw you. That is brilliant.
Yeah, I don't
know. Because it's not every distributor is twisting
nefarious.
Their mustache.
Yeah,
they're not they're not twisting their mustache going, ha ha. Some are,
but not all.
Some and arguably many, but there are that just, you're right. Don't know what they're doing. Couldn't figure it out. The market shifted. Their marketing plan or their release plan was like DVD and it's 2020.
Yeah. Well, one of them dies. I mean, that's happened, you know, like, So, again, with the
film festival aspect, the reason I'm bringing that up is because mm-hmm. I want filmmakers to understand that film festivals, looking for a distributor to a film festival, yeah, it's great and it's nice, but if you can get an MG, if you can get some money, but it's not the end all be all again. I love the way you're looking at it more so, where like you're building quantity of film festivals for your movie, which, by the way, makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's a film festival style movie. Yeah, it is an arty kind of film in that sense. You know what I mean, though?
Yet, it's like, entertaining.
Entertaining. No, yeah, but arty, exactly. But entertaining, but it plays at festivals, where a horror movie doesn't really benefit, maybe a little bit here and there, depending on the festival.
Well, I mean, there's a whole circuit of genre festivals now that's becoming just as big or bigger or more
fantastic.
Important.
Fantastic.
But the other thing I think that's interesting that the pandemic has kind of accelerated is the kind of the fuzziness between festivals and art house theaters, which is to say now there's a lot more festivals that are doing revenue sharing. I just got a check yesterday from the festival. I didn't even know what was doing revenue share. And I was like, wow, it wasn't for a lot, but it was for something. And also a lot of festivals are doing year-round programming. So even if you don't get into the festival, they may still program you 6 months later. So you have to be nice to everyone when they reject you. And then likewise, a lot of art house theaters are doing more with Q&As and Zoom Q&As and bringing filmmakers in. So it's getting a little fuzzy, but you know, there is some revenue you can make. I mean, we've made money on our festival circuit. I mean, bottom line, you know, between awards and revenue sharing, it's not a lot, but something.
Yeah. And you know what? I think that is, you're right, because everyone's just trying to survive. So they understand that like a week of film festivals probably not going to, you know, pay the nut. Exactly. So we're going to have to do things differently, stretch it out over
the year. Buy theaters and then they become year-round programmers themselves.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And they could start making money. And then there's a revenue sharing part. So now the filmmaker's incentivized to work with them, not only for exposure, because maybe it won't be the moment of all the press and attention on that week or 2 weeks that they're running their festival, but now it's a business deal. Like, hey, we'll run your movie. It's a rev share. Do you want to do it in Omaha? Yes. Why wouldn't you?
No, I mean, 5 days ago, we had a screening in Annapolis that was run by the Annapolis Film Festival, which we, for whatever reason, I think I forgot to apply, but they do a year-round programming, and that was a revenue share screening, you know, and we did it as a sneak preview for the film. So, yeah, there's a lot of great opportunities out there now.
Now, tell me about your film 18 and a half, because when, I mean, you've been talking about this for a while now. and if anyone who knows Dan, if you are in his circle, you will know when he's making a movie. You will know everything about that movie. You'll know when he's film crowdfunding for it. You will know when it's being released, you know, so all the, as he drinks from his 18 and a half cup.
Absolutely.
So tell everybody, I think you already mentioned what the movie is about, but one question I wanted to ask you about it is, how did you raise the money this time for it? Was it like a bunch of different ways?
Yeah. So with most of my films, I start with crowdfunding. This one we did on Seed and Spark, other films I've done on Kickstarter. And the goal is usually to raise about 10 or 15% of the budget that way. I mean, it's Kickstarter, not Kick Finisher, or Seed and Spark, not Fire and Tree.
Seed and Fire.
Yeah. So, and you know, and you do, you know, like most people, I do like a month long campaign, you know, for that. And that's, you know, but really the goal is not about the money. It's about building that community, the 300 backers that you get. And, you know, Dave, your old bass player buddy from college, may give you $40, but when he posts the video on his Facebook page and his brother-in-law, the Silicon Valley investor, gives you $10,000, that's the power of crowdfunding. It's kind of the Trojan horse to then get you to slightly bigger levels. But the other thing that I do is I always work with a 501c3 as a fiscal sponsor. So the last couple of films has been the Film Collaborative, because they're one of the few ones that will work with narrative films. There's a lot more that do documentaries. And I kind of use that as almost more like a Patreon or OnlyFans page where people can give money, you know, year round, or over the course of 2 or 3 years.
So when you partner with a 501c, that means that they're a nonprofit. So that means it's tax deductible.
Yeah. For the donor. Because a lot of rich people, they just want a tax deduction right away. Cause I always tell them, look, and then the third thing is equity investment. Like, do you want to invest in the film? So I said, well, look, you can invest in the film, but truthfully, you're not going to make your money back. So if you just want to get a tax write-off now, this year, then the other way to do it is you donate to the 501c3. They keep 5% of it for administrative costs for their kickback. And then the filmmaker gets the rest of the money, and you never have to pay that money back. So it's kind of a win-win for the donor, the fiscal sponsor, and the filmmaker.
What were the percentages of each one for the budget?
So I think on this film, I think 2/3 of the budget did come from equity investors, investors. And then, you know, that other third was kind of split between crowdfunding through Seed and Spark and the fiscal sponsor, for the most, donations that came, tax deductible donations. So it's winds up being a fair percentage of it. And again, it can, just by giving people those options, doesn't mean they're going to take them, but it shows that you're kind of honest and realistic about your expectations. Like, dude, I told you weren't going to make money. If you want to roll the dice and invest, great, I'll take it that way. But if you don't, and want to get the deduction this year, that's fine too. And I think investors appreciate that, like, okay, well, Dan gave me all the options and was realistic and told me all these distributors were going to go bankrupt, and wow, they did, you know? So that's, I put it right there in the business plan, and sure enough, that's what happens every time. So, but they're all along for the ride. I mean, I still send them all the same updates and get the same, you know, they get the same swag options and they all are part of that community that's building that film.
That's awesome, man. Now, casting, you have a pretty awesome cast for this film. How do you, I mean, obviously people know who you are. You have a filmography now. So it's not like you're starting from scratch, but do you just essentially cast the same way you cast anybody would cast a film? You'd send out, call their agent up and go, hey, or if you have a direct connection, you try to go to a direct way and then negotiate afterwards?
Yeah, my kind of, and funny you should say that, there's a chapter in my book about how to get A-list actors in a micro-budget film.
And the name of that book, sir? And the name of that book?
The Cheerful Subversive's Guide to Independent Filmmaking.
Now available.
Second edition.
Now available on audiobook. Edition.
Yes, and available on audiobook, which I get a higher percentage of than the print book. Yes. But yeah, the main thing I do that may be a little bit unique is I start with New York agents and New York agents. Agencies or the branches of Hollywood agencies in New York. And if you can get in with a junior agent or an assistant that's about to hit agent.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And ask them their, like, don't come in with a pre-existing list. Like, you may have one, but don't tell them about it. Say, look, I respect you. You went to Brown. You have a comp lit degree. You know, you're paying back your financial, you know, your student debt. You must be smart. Who do you think would be good? And all of a sudden, like, you're asking them their opinion and their advice. And then they come back and they're pitching people to you. You're not begging people from them. And that just flips the dynamic. Right. And that's exactly what happened on this film. It was a junior agent at one of the Paradigm, I think, who I had worked with on the last film. So I knew him already. And he had gotten me someone on the last film. And on this film, he was like, oh, you got to meet with Willa Fitzgerald. And I was like, Willa who? Never heard of her, you know? And he said, no, she's fantastic. Trust me. And I was like, all right, fine. I was in New York. I met with her. She was great. And then I found out she'd been in a film that Lucky McKee, it was an old friend of mine from the USC Ryan Johnson days. He recommended her. He said, oh yeah, she's great to work with. And we considered other people along the way, but kind of came back around to her, you know, week before shooting. And of course, you know, we shoot the film. She's great. She's wonderful to work with, fantastic performance. And then she winds up doing Reacher afterwards and just came out as that and shoots up to number two on the star meter. Like today, we never could have gotten her, but she's still great. You know, she's still wonderful, supportive actress. But I talked to a lot of other directors too. So I was thinking about John Magaro and I reached out to Kelly Reichardt, who I know just a little bit, but she, you know, she said, oh yeah, he was great in First Cow. You should cast him. And I did, you know. You know, someone like John Cryer, though, is someone that I met 30 years ago when he and Richard Schenkman were making indie films. And they came up to me at a screening and said, oh, how did you make Omaha the movie? You know, because they were making Gone to Coney Island, you know, Be Back. And so I've kind of stayed in touch with him a little bit through Twitter, but we still had to go through his agency, you know, even though I kind of knew him. You know, Bruce Campbell, who plays the voice of Nixon, you know, was someone that I had. We tried to get him on the last film and schedule didn't work out. So I kind of, same thing, but I knew his agent and through his agent was able to get to him. And, you know, but also we made it easy for some of these guys, for Bruce and for Ted Raimi and for John Cryer. We said, look, it's a couple hours of work voiceover. Cause they're the 18 and a half minute gap. And it'll be sometime in post-production. You don't even have to commit to a date at this point. And in the end, we wound up recording that during the pandemic. Because we started shooting March 3rd, 2020. What could possibly go wrong? We shot for 11 days, had to shut down. We had 4 days left to go. But in the process, we took a 6-month gap. And during that 6 months where nobody was doing anything, I was like, you know what? Let's do the voice performance now and let's do it over Zoom. We don't have to worry about getting everyone in the same studio at the same time and flying people in. It'll be cheaper, easier. They all had pretty decent mics by that point and they were sitting around not doing anything.
And it's on a tape. It's supposed to be recorded
exactly.
Audio.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So it worked really well for us. But all of a sudden, like June of 2020, where no actors were doing anything, like we were making part of our movie, you know, over Zoom. But availability and schedule is the key thing. I mean, we were already a week into shooting the film. We didn't know who two of our actors were going to be because someone else had dropped out. And again, I called an agent who's the head of talent at Gersh, this guy, Alex Yarosh, who I knew because he was an assistant 20 years ago. And we used to hang out and make photocopies together, you know. And so having those kind of relationships. And I could say, hey, dude, I need someone, you know, in 36 hours. He's like, how about Vondi Curtis Hall? I'm like, Emmy winner Vondi Curtis Hall? Yeah, you bet. You know, and sure enough, he shows up and is amazing in the film. And a lovely, absolute treat to work with. So, so developing these relationships with talent agents, as opposed to like lit agents, I haven't had my own agent in 15 or 20 years, you know, but having those kind of personal relationships with agents and managers, you know, because they may have 20 clients. So even if the one person on your list can't do it, they may come back and suggest someone else. You know, that was that's how I've gotten a lot of people over the years, including Julia Stiles, you know, for my movie Between Us, because she was in a play. The financing fell through 2 hours ago. She's completely distraught. And the agent's like, do you want me to send her the script? And I was like, yeah. 24 hours later, she says yes. 2 weeks later, she's in my kitchen rehearsing, you know.
And there you go.
So that was something, you know, we learned a little bit from Robert Altman, was set that start date, tell everyone train's leaving the station and see who shows up, you know. And
I have to ask you, man, what was it like, you know, having worked with Bob, like I know him, Robert, sir, Mr. Altman, yeah. If you will, what was it like having Mr. Altman, you know, mentor you, man?
Yeah, well, it was, you know, it was a funny coincidence. I was, you know, I'm from Omaha and I went back to Omaha to shoot my film. And I said to the film commission, look, I know actors here, but I need a local producer. And they say, well, there's this guy, Dana, who, you know, works construction during the day, but he's been producing commercials. He wants to get into, you know, features so he doesn't have to pour cement all the time. And they said, oh, and by the way, his grandfather's Robert Altman. I said, he's hired. And and since then, Dana Altman still lives in Omaha and actually lives on a farm outside of Omaha now and is still one of my producing partners. But we, you know, then Robert Altman, Bob, you know, came on board kind of as our mentor on that film. And then I got to know him a little bit after and spent a couple of days on the set of Kansas City watching him work, you know. And yeah, I mean, it's there's still things that he did that I do, you know, miking every actor individually is a technique that he pioneered with MASH in Nashville. And I 100% do it on every one of my films. And it's more than just like miking individual actors, but it's also then encouraging them to, okay, now that you've got this mic, talk over each other, you know, like do overlapping dialogue. And then all of a sudden, even though the script is pretty, certainly on 18 and a half, it's a very well scripted script. There's not a lot of real improvisation, but it's a much more naturalistic performances that you get out of actors by encouraging them to do that and having the confidence in yourself that in editing, you can work with it too. But it also means that you never have ADR. So you never have those false ADR performances that you're falling back on, which most films do. So there was a lot of the nuances that I learned from Altman, more than just the technical technique, but the kind of the reasons why. I mean, he said point blank, he said, I don't want the lowest paid person on the crew, the boom operator, to make the creative decisions about who I want going to listen to. And that's what it was like up until then. He's like, I'm the artist. I'm going to be the one making that decision myself. So, which was really blunt talk, but it was true. And then, you know, and then he combined that with the kind of the wandering zoom lens, which I don't do as much of. I use in 18 and a half, there's a lot of zooming, but it's kind of for a slightly different, you know, creative purpose. But also his philosophy on just make the film, make whatever, you know. I mean, it's amazing how many films he made, that most of which most people have never heard of, but he just kept doing it over and over again, you know. And that feeling of or that philosophy of set the start date, tell everyone the train's leaving the station. And the interesting thing is, the closer you get to that start date, and you've got to have, you know, iron cojones to pull it off, really, and you have to have backups in mind for cast. Oh. But, you know, very often, and it's been true in my case, you get better higher level name actors the closer you get, because actors are not just motivated by money, and agents are mostly motivated by money, but not entirely. They're also all motivated by insecurity and fear. So an agent doesn't want to have an actor calling them up. Why don't I have anything next week? Why don't I have anything next week? And eventually they'll say, all right, fine. There's this crappy little indie film. There's no money in it, but just get out of my hair, go do this thing. And actors love to work. You know, they hate a vacuum in their schedule because they never know when they're going to be working next again. So, you know, so that was something we really kind of embraced and learned from Altman.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. Now, where can people watch your new movie, 18 and a half?
In theaters only. This is not a day and date situation. So you have to go to movie theaters. We are helping bring theaters back, whether they want us to or not, and bring people back into theaters. So on May 27th, it is opening in Los Angeles at Lemley's for a week-long Oscar qualifying run, because it's an honor just to be eligible, and playing in a few other Lemley theaters around LA and also New York City. We have a big premiere May 27th in Brooklyn. And then June 1st, we have a big premiere in Washington, D.C. And then June 3rd, it opens coast to coast around the country, North America. And eventually it's going to be probably in about 50 theaters nationwide. And for about 5 weeks until it hits VOD.
So then, and this is through a theatrical distributor.
Yeah. That's Adventure awesome. Entertainment.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That's awesome.
The name of the company. Yeah.
Dan, you are an inspiration, my friend, to say the least. you inspire me all the time, dude. Seriously. Like, I see you working and doing your thing, man. I'm just like, you hustle hard, brother. Hustle recognizes hustle, man. There's no question about it. And you're still, and like, man, you're still doing it, dude. All these years.
I know.
You just like, you're insane. You are the definition of an insane filmmaker. You are.
I keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
Yep. Well, you all do, but you have a good time. You have a good time doing
it. Yeah. And that's the key. And I think also, and this is something I remember when I first went to South By in 95, there was this great panel discussion and it was, you know, all the big wigs of the indie film. It was Steven Soderbergh and Richard Linklater and Robert Rodriguez all kinds of Allison Anders maybe was there. And then Greg Araki was there. And I remember something Greg said, because he was there with Doom Generation, but he'd made five tiny, tiny little 60mm weird films to get to that point. He said, look, all these other guys got to Sundance, hit the ball out of the park, got a big home run, their first at bat. And I didn't do that. You know, Greg's like, you know, I had to keep struggling, making one film after another film after another film. But five films later, I'm literally on the same panel with these guys. I'm on the same pantheon and making films at a similar budget level. And he said, you know, look, you can either hit the ball out of the park at bat, but, you know, that we know that's 1% of filmmakers every year, or you just build a body of work. You just keep at it and keep making films. And eventually someone will recognize, oh, wow, this filmmaker's made a bunch of films. There must be something there, you know? And that to me is still like, you know, the inspiration. Just keep on making them, because you know, and it's not because you think anyone is going to hit the ball out of the park, you know, they may not, but eventually people are going to go, oh, wow, this person's made some halfway decent films. You know, you add them together, maybe there's at least one decent film in there, you know?
Exactly. Brother, man, thank you again for coming on the show. You're welcome back anytime, as you know.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to what you do next, what insanity you're coming up with next.
Still plenty of, you know, I'm still beating this dead horse. You know, so 18 and a half, the soundtrack is out this week on iTunes and you know, Spotify, different things like that. There's talk of turning it into a play. There's some chatter of turning it into a TV series. It's mostly me chattering, but still there is chatter. And, you know, and I know it's going to take a while to do the DVD and the Blu-ray. So this is going to keep me busy for a while. So yeah, get used to me still, you know,
talking about this for at least another year.
For a while. Yeah, exactly. and that's part of what you need to do. Like you can't just give up, you know.
You can't just be like, oh, I'm done. Oh, the final cut's done. Whoosh. Okay, let me start working on my next movie. No, you got about another year, 2 years on
absolutely.
This one.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're lucky because all of us, you know, had a good time on this one, despite a pandemic, or maybe because of it. I don't know. And we're all excited to keep working on it together.
Brother, man, thanks again for coming on the show. Keep inspiring us all, my friend. I appreciate you.
Thank you, Alex.
I want to thank Dan so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so, so much. Dan is truly a inspiration for all indie filmmakers out there. So Dan, thank you for doing what you do, my friend. If you want to check out how to watch his new film, 18 and a half, or pick up his amazing book, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/583. And if you haven't already,
please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It truly helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.